for me?
Yes, my name is Ken Lillard.
And what's your date of birth, Ken?
January 22nd, 1924.
Okay. Can you tell me when you first came to Union County?
In the early part of December 1944.
And what was it that brought you to this area?
I was employed by Inland Radio Incorporated, or KLBM, here in La Grande.
Can you tell me more about that assignment?
Well, years ago, I had an interesting experience in a history class where they set up a little sort of a radio station within the school, and I volunteered to do some announcing work on that, which was really very brief. But I enjoyed doing that sort of thing, and then consequently we were in California living there, and a friend of mine suggested that I should go to a radio broadcasting school because she thought that I had the voice for radio. So I went to this school in Beverly Hills for 3 months. One of the instructors sort of took a liking to me and said, I'm going to Portland, Oregon to open, well, not to really open a school, but to teach in one that was just opening. So eventually I ended up in Portland and sent out a number of audition records, and one was sent to La Grande, KLBM, and I was hired, and so I came here.
Okay. Now, many people listening to this tape may not know what a record is. So why don't we start by maybe a description of a record?
I mentioned the record that I mailed to a number of radio stations, which was an audition record, and those were made of glass. They were probably 8 or 10 inches diameter, and you recorded on those, and they did not last very long because if you played them several times, they just wore out. Then in the radio broadcasting field, a record would be the same size of a disc and made out of a more durable substance and was played and recorded at 78 revolutions per minute. That's a record.
Okay. So tell me more about what happened when you arrived in La Grande to take on this position.
Well, that's a little difficult to answer in a way. I came to La Grande as a disc jockey. KLBM was the only radio station in Union County at that time, 250 watts of power. The manager was one Gordon Capps. He was a fine gentleman, and I went to work, I think I came here on a Sunday, went to work on the following day, Monday, and of course you are, quote, broken in, showed the routine of what you had to do, and subsequently got into sales.
Now, when you first started on that first day, what did your job entail? What did you have to do?
Playing records and reading commercials, reading news. The news was world and national news that came from a teletype. A teletype from United Press that brought in the news that you would read on the air.
Okay. Can you describe for me how a teletype worked?
Well, it was hooked up by telephone lines, actually, and looked or operated a great deal like a typewriter would. Had the keys that would fly up, you know, to make the numbers or the letters, just like an ordinary typewriter would. However, it was encased in a cabinet-type thing. It had a roll of paper that was threaded through the machine, and the information would be typed on this paper, and it would continually roll out of the teletype until such time that you came in and tore the paper off, and then the various stories that it encompassed, while you would tear those off, and usually there would be a place for national news, regional news, or whatever.
Did this operate 24 hours a day?
Yes. And so you'd go in and select the newscast, which you knew which one it was, and tear it up and maybe glance through it to see if there are any words you couldn't pronounce, and then broadcast them.
Mm-hmm. So these were live broadcasts?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me a little more about the music that you played when you first started.
Well, it was, to us, popular music that included bands such as Glenn Miller, Duke Ellington, Jimmy Dorsey, Tommy Dorsey, some of those. And back then in radio, you did more than just play dance music. You might have a hour, or not probably an hour, but half an hour of military music. You might have concert music that would maybe last for an hour. Mm-hmm. And it would be interspersed with news, commercials, public service announcements, and that sort of thing.
How much freedom did you have in choosing the music that was played?
Entirely your choice.
We were talking about the freedom that you had in playing and choosing the types of music that you had. What other things were going on during your day?
Well, in addition to records, we had what was called a transcription library. These were large discs that probably were maybe 18 to 20 inches in diameter, and they would have probably five, maybe six selections on each side. Actually, if you took a long play disc that has been fairly recent here, it would be the same thing as a transcription, only a larger disc and all. They had all kinds of musical selections in the transcription library, and it was something that a company would lease you. You pay X amount of dollars per month for its use, and you had every month new transcriptions coming in to freshen up your library.
Now, these weren't for the personal consumer. They were just strictly for the radio industry?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell me more about the selection process in choosing the music. Was there anything about the area that sort of predicted what you would play? Because you had come from the city, so I would imagine things maybe were a little bit different in a rural area than in the city.
I really don't think so, because my experience in the city was quite limited, because I was not involved in any way really with radio. I even didn't listen to it too often. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think there was anything specific about Union County that you would select certain numbers for use.
Mm-hmm. As far as the public service announcements, how were those generated?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I remember positively, but I assume that, like Red Cross, possibly cancer and some of the others, would send discs to you that you'd play on the air. Some of them were live announcements or printed announcements you would read live.
How many of those announcements were really pertaining to local events rather than national?
Well, back then, when I first came to Le Grand, I would say that there weren't a lot that pertained to local organizations. Later in my broadcast experience, and then we did do a lot of local public service announcements.
How long do you suppose it took for people to start to recognize that you were the voice on the radio?
Oh, not too long, I would say. If I may, I will mention that there was an hour program called This Is Your Favorite. It was a request program. People would send in a card or letter and requesting that you play something for somebody. And so that's what you did. You would pick the selection that they wanted, and you would read the request that they had sent in and play it. Mm-hmm. And I know there will be some people that will say, oh, KLBM stands for Ken Lillard's Big Mouth.
Oh, no.
My secretary later on said, no, it means brilliant mind. That'll cost you.
So you were a little well known then.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
How significant do you think KLBM was in an area? You said it was the first radio, the only radio. So how significant was that to this area?
Oh, I think very. We did a lot of things for the community, and I think KLBM was definitely a community-minded radio station. We participated in all sorts of things. The Eastern Oregon Livestock Show, the Elgin Stampede, the Union County Fair. We had set up a remote broadcast from the fairgrounds, and I bet we did 8 or 10 broadcasts from there. I can recall early in my years here that we even took the teletype to the broadcast booth that we had at the fairgrounds, and I would go out like at 7 in the morning and do the first radio broadcast news from there. And if people lost their dog or their cat or something, they'd call and we'd put it on the air. And, you know, for that family, that was pretty important. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we promoted and assisted in many other ways. The Salvation Army, the blood drawing for the Red Cross, and you name it, we did it.
Were there any festivities or areas that you really tried to steer clear of?
No, I don't really think so.
Okay. And on those same lines, was there certain words or kind of lingo that were just, what am I trying to say? that you couldn't use on the radio, or places where you just had to really be careful, certain topics maybe?
Well, that's true. You didn't run into that so much here as in your larger areas and the networks and that sort of thing, but there were words that you just steered clear of on the radio. Pregnancy is one of them, for an example. And others that I don't care to mention right here.
Okay. Now, as you sort of advanced in your position, tell me what happened next.
Well, I guess I got into more of selling advertising and eventually became manager, and then after a number of years I bought KLBM Radio.
Okay. Let's back up just a little bit then to the days of advertising. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
Advertising. Tell me what that was like. What would be an average day?
Well, you had certain accounts that you would call on, and you would go to that store, talk to the manager, and present him a number of suggestions that would be helpful for their business by the use of radio advertising.
Were these written by yourself?
Usually, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess they'd either buy it or they wouldn't.
But it was mainly a face-to-face sales call.
Yes, yes.
You didn't rely on phoning or...
Occasionally you would telephone, but generally it was a face-to-face thing.
Was it popular for the local businesses to advertise on the radio?
Quite. It took a while. When Inland Radio bought KLBM, it was the station hadn't been on the air a long time, a few years, and I think KLBM went on the air probably in 37 or 38, and Inland Radio bought the station, probably in 42 or 43, somewhere around in there.
Mm-hmm.
I came in 44, and the radio station had to be built up from a standpoint of doing a good job, gaining listenership, and subsequently, it became a very important facet of the community and the development of business for local businesses.
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't ask when you first got here, where was the station located?
It was on the old Highway 30. Currently, it was, if you went past like Le Schwab, there is a right-hand turn to Weimart. And it was just about where that turn is where the building was located.
Can you tell me more about that building? How large was it?
It was not very large. It was actually an old home. And there would have been, an office to the left as you entered, and the office where you went into the right of that would be the newsroom, and if you went right straight from the door that you entered, you'd go into the studio, and to the left of that was the record library and the transmitter room. That's it.
Where did you spend most of your time?
Well, probably in the studio or the transmitter room, because that's where you played the records and did the announcing for the most part.
Can you tell me any more then about of the setup of the studio? Some of the equipment involved, maybe?
Well, in the studio, there wasn't very much, a table and a chair and a microphone. There we had a piano, and that's about all.
Did you play the piano on the air?
No. No, I guess it was there. There was a religious broadcast. I think it was on Sundays. I remember. And they had people who would sing, and they'd use the piano then.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have people in for a live interview?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What sorts of people would be typical to interview?
Oh, people from the school district, from the Chamber of Commerce. When I became manager, I hired a gentleman by the name of Bob Mask, and he was the local news director and gathered local news, interviewed people, and he would interview people from the Oregon State Fish and Wildlife. He interviewed Governor Tom McCall when he was on the campaign trail to be elected, and incidentally sent Bob a letter afterwards saying that Bob had done one of the best interviews that he had had on that trip.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall any interviews that really stand out in your mind?
I don't think so.
We're talking about some of your more notable interviews. Did you think of some that you...
We at that time were located in the Sagdria Hotel. Now it's where the U.S. National Bank is located. But in the lobby of the hotel, I recall that Julie Eisenhower, no, that's her name now, Julie Nixon, who is the daughter of Richard Nixon, and David Eisenhower, the grandson of Dwight D. Eisenhower, were in the lobby of the hotel, and we met them, and they were interviewed on the air by somebody, wasn't me. Mm-hmm. And we did have certain personalities that had, like, a Western musical group, like T. Texas Tyler, and I remember broadcasting a certain amount of music of his live. And there was a place in La Grande called Zuber Hall. Maybe you have heard of that. It was subsequently called Arella's Garden. Arella's Garden. And she would bring in, almost on a weekly basis, a name band. And we would always broadcast a half hour from there on KLBM. And that was always a fun time.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you had made a switch now to the Sacagawea Hotel. When did KLBM make that move?
I'm not really sure that I could tell you that. I don't know. I don't know if I have it in my notes or not. No.
Well, at some point you did move from that house out past West Schwab into the hotel. Can you tell me what that was like, making that move?
Oh, that was as exciting as possibly could imagine. We took over almost the entire mezzanine, and we built our offices, the studio, the transmitter room, the control room, the newsroom, the record library, everything on the mezzanine. And it was one of the best places to be. because if anything important was going to happen, it would happen at the Sacagawea Hotel. And we were right there. We'd easily get a hold of somebody and bring them into the studio and do an interview with them, for example. And so we had a lot of exciting times there.
Had you taken on the role of manager at that point?
Yes.
So what was that like, switching over from sales and from the disc jockey position and going into management?
Well, in management, in addition to personnel and all of those things, I still sold advertising and would tape commercials and type them and that sort of thing. So it was just an addition to my routine to be manager.
So your workload increased?
It did.
More so than your responsibility, the different responsibilities?
It did, yes.
And from manager, then you made another step up.
Yeah, a particular time came when I wanted to buy the station and Mr. Capps was willing to sell to me. So I bought KLBM radio. And let's see, when could that have been? I purchased that in the year of 1972. And subsequently there was another radio station that went on the air as an FM station. And they were not successful, so I bought that out in 1977.
So as manager and then as owner, were there any specific issues that you had to deal with as far as the radio industry itself?
I'm not sure that I understand the question.
Well, you had mentioned earlier about some of the issues in a larger city with having networks and that kind of a thing. And here, I gathered that you were more independent. But were there issues that you really had to be aware of in working on the radio?
Oh, I don't think particularly that you had to be aware of. You, of course, participated in a variety of things. As manager, owner, I attempted to be involved with things like the Chamber of Commerce, and I was chairman of the Red Cross Board of Directors and that type of thing. You naturally just worked with them and offered your services of the broadcast station as needed.
Mm-hmm. So I gather that the importance of community then was really...
Still very important.
Okay.
I guess maybe something that is a sideline that was probably helpful for the community. LeGrand experienced a flood. They experienced two forest fires. And KLBM was at their disposal in any way that we could be, and the announcers at the radio station would accept calls from officials telling people what they should do, and particularly in the fighting of the fire, volunteers would go to a particular area and we would tell them, you know, volunteers are needed in another location. And that's the way that went.
Today is February 17th, 2005, and I'm here for a second interview with Ken Lillard. And I wanted to just go back a little bit. We want to clarify a couple of things. Ken, can you tell me, at one point we were talking about words that wouldn't have been appropriate on the radio, and you wanted to make a correction.
Yes, I mentioned that pregnancy was not used on the air. We didn't have any problem with that. We never used the word or the term. But swear words and maybe some items that would be advertised, we wouldn't use those. Then I think you asked, when did we move to the Sagdry Hotel? That was in 1955.
Okay. Thank you for those clarifications. Now, we also sort of ended the tape talking about a fire and the importance of having the radio station here in a situation like that, because you were able to distribute volunteers into certain areas where they were needed. Were there any other events like that occurred where you felt like a radio was really a key part of organization perhaps?
I don't remember of anything of that particular nature. One thing that might be of interest, the Salvation Army had collected, under $2,000 for their Christmas fund. This was just a while before Christmas, and somebody broke in and stole it. So I got on the radio and made the announcement and said something to the effect that if we could get 1,700 people to donate $1, they'd recoup their losses. Well, we ended up, I don't remember now, but somewhere close to $4,000.
Wow. So the radio was not only important in times of negative situations, but also in positive ways for fundraising.
Right, huh? We did quite a bit of that. And I don't know, there's probably other areas, but they don't come to mind right now.
Okay. Your wife had mentioned off tape some fun times at the radio station. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, we had a lot of fun. It was a good time to be in radio. I think what she referred to was at election time. We would have people at the various precincts at 8 o'clock when the polls closed, and they would jot down the vote tally at that time, would bring them to the radio station, and we had a couple of people with adding machines, and we would total those up and broadcast them on the air. And we had, you know, various types of refreshments, and all kinds of people would come out to check on how the election was going, as well as listening to it. And we'd have a crowd of people, and it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And you had also mentioned that you participated in sporting events. What were some of those events like?
We would broadcast the LeGrand High School football games, basketball games, and most of the Eastern Oregon College, it was called then, games also. And I think probably that was the extent of the sporting events that we broadcast locally. And they all had their challenges, of course.
Were there challenges that involved technology, for instance, trying to get set up in these remote locations?
Not so much technology as, maybe a piece of equipment would not be working properly, or the telephone company had failed to put up what they called a patch, which would patch us into the phone line so we could get the broadcast on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Tell me a little more about the licensing requirements and your relationship with the FCC.
I can't remember. I think it was every 4 years you had to have your license renewed. And back then it was quite a task, because you had to make a list of all the public service announcements that you did, public relations, news, entertainment, all sorts of things, and this required a lot of time and effort to compile all of this information and then put it down on their forms to present back to the FCC for license renewal. So it was a job.
Mm-hmm. Where were their headquarters located?
Washington, D.C.
So you were communicating via mail with them?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So how long did the process take to get your licensing?
I suppose it would take a couple of months, not hour from hour to hour, but over a period of a couple of months to put all this information together and then send it to the FCC, and then it would take another probably 2 or 3 months for them to give you your license renewal.
Do you suppose that it's a lot more lenient now?
I think it is. In fact, I think that about the last one I did before I got out of the business was more or less a postcard type thing. And you had a very few questions to answer, and that took care of it.
Why do you suppose that there has been such a drastic change?
Because I think a lot of the information that we had to garner really wasn't that important.
Oh.
Government.
Okay. How long did you end up staying in the Sacagawea Hotel?
Well, we left there in 1970. So it would have been about 15 years that we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd looked around town for a new location to move to, and there just wasn't anything large enough to handle the situation. So we owned property where the tower was located on Cove Avenue, and we built a modular building there, and we moved into that in 1970. And incidentally, it took us 2 weeks to build that. There was a gentleman in Elgin that, because we were right, boy, we were having to move from the hotel because they were already dismantling plumbing and that sort of thing. So we had to move in a hurry, and we had 2 weeks in which to get out. And I remember Ivan Tillery said, "I can have a building up for you in 2 weeks." Mm-hmm. And he did, and we moved out, and I don't think we lost more than 8 hours of airtime to make the move.
How disappointing was that, to leave the hotel where you had really been the center of attention in that building?
Well, we were really outgrowing the area, so it's sort of a necessity to move because we needed more space. And then subsequently we put the FM on the air, and we just wouldn't have had room for that. So mixed emotions about that.
Mm-hmm. Can you say anything about your personal view of them tearing down the hotel?
Well, the floor in the lobby was made of marble, as well as the steps up to the mezzanine. And they would bring the pipes from the plumbing up the, 7 or 8 floors, to bring it down to the lobby and just drop it. And it made a horrendous noise. And of course, all of that went on the air if we had a microphone open. So I remember that. And I also remember seeing caterpillars on like the second or third floor up there tearing things out. And to think of the strength of that building, and it took a lot longer to bring the building down than they thought it would, simply because of the structure. Mm-hmm. And I think if that were to happen today, people would not allow it to be torn down.
Mm-hmm. Was there a sense of sadness in the community?
Well, I think so, yeah. Because it was quite a landmark, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it had the coffee shop also, and had the what they called the large and the small ballrooms. And the large ballroom is where they would hold dances. The small ballroom, if it was a small dance, but they would also serve the Rotary and the Lions clubs there, too.
So a lot of activity ceased at that time.
Oh, yes, you bet. Too bad.
Mm-hmm, it is. So let's switch over then to the Cove building. What was it like out there moving into a new building?
Well, it was exciting, like any other new place you move into. And, of course, we had more room. We eventually put the FM station on. There was an FM station went on the air, and they were not successful, so I bought the equipment and everything, and we put that on the air. We did have to add on a room for that, even there. And it was really exciting. And for the first, I think, couple of years, we programmed beautiful music, which I loved. But you just couldn't sell much advertising with that format.
Mm-hmm.
So we changed to country western back then. And that's what we held, or what we programmed then on the FM.
Tell me what the difference is between AM and FM radio.
AM is audio modulation, and FM is frequency modulation. And don't ask me further questions, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I don't know what that means either. Was there a difference in, as far as running a business between the two types of radio?
Not really, because you sold advertising for both, and you had salespeople that sold both stations, and the commercials that you would put together were used on both stations, or could be.
Mm-hmm.
And so the operation was the only thing that was different. The FM was automated, and the AM, you had a board operator and an announcer there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what made the difference.
Was there any difference in the types of music played?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
On the AM station, we broadcast what we called adult contemporary, and then at night, more the rock music.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on the FM, the first couple of years was, like I say, beautiful music, and then we changed to country, and that was what you broadcast all day long and into the evening.
When you say beautiful music, give me an example.
Mantovani would be one. Others don't come to mind, but it was that type of, it wasn't classical by no means, but it was just beautiful music.
And you have many, many memories, I suppose, over the years with radio. Can you tell me about some of the most memorable people or events?
Well, I think the most memorable people would have been Warren Curry, who is our chief engineer, and Bob Mask, who I've mentioned earlier. He was our local newsman. And, of course, the rest of the staff were very good people, and did a good job for me, but both Warren and Bob worked for me much longer than anybody else. Mm-hmm. So they were two nice guys and would do anything for you. I guess I don't think of anything specific other than the fact that radio was something that I enjoyed tremendously. And I remember coming to Le Grand. I'll tell you, I was on cloud nine because I was in radio. There was three theaters here in Le Grand when I came here. And the Liberty Theater, which is where Domino's is now, and another little business there. And that large stage. And we would broadcast amateur programs from there, give away turkeys at Christmas and Thanksgiving. And I always had the pleasure of getting somebody up on the stage to draw the lucky number, you know. And so there were a lot of things. There were a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Good memories.
Now, speaking of important people, we have alluded to your wife throughout this interview, but we haven't really discussed her very much. And so tell me about this special person in your life and how you came to know her.
I was selling advertising at the time, as well as doing a shift on the board. And there was a little ladies' shop called the Rosanna Shop, Ladies Ray Jouer. And I serviced that account. In other words, I sold them advertising. And the manager there said, I'd like you to meet the lady or the girl that works here. Well, it happened to be Frances Elam, who I call Frankie. And we had a date or several, and after 7 months got married, and have been married now for 58 years. And I thought it seemed like 38, you know.
Well, that's a nice thing to say. And did you have children?
We had two sons, Gary and Roger. Gary is in Le Grand, works at the River Bend. It's a Youth Alliance, I believe is what they call it. And our younger son, Roger, is with Piper Jaffray in Portland.
Did they ever have any desire to get on the radio with Dad?
Oh, yeah. Roger came to me one day when he was a senior, and he said, Dad, I'd really like to be a radio announcer. I said, well, Roger, you got to really be able to read well in order to be an announcer. And he said, okay. And I said, when you think you're ready, why, put an audition tape on my desk. He did, and I was surprised that he did as well as he did. So he worked for me for, I think, a couple of years, and then went to Napa, Idaho, to KFXD. Gary did some sales work for me. When Bob Mask would be on vacation, while Gary would fill in as the newsman. And he also did the secretarial work when the secretary was gone. This would be typing up the program logs and putting the commercials on that and so forth. And they both did a good job.
Did you ever get Frankie on the air?
No, I don't think so.
No?
No, don't believe so.
As a note to the editors here, we want to go back and make a little addition to the part about the owners of Inland Radio Group. Ken, can you give me more information about that?
Originally, it was owned by Marshall Cornett and Lee Jacobs. Lee was in Baker, and Marshall Cornett, I think, lived in Salem or Portland and was a state representative. He and the governor, which was Governor Snell at that time, and one or two other people, I think, were in a small plane, and it crashed, and every one of them was killed. So Marshall's wife, Olive, kind of stepped in and took over for him and worked with Lee Jacobs. And then Lee was killed in an automobile accident, at which time then Gordon Capp sort of stepped in and took over his duties and responsibilities. And I did not know Marshall Cornett, but his wife Olive was she was a wonderful lady, and had a lot of good people involved in Inland Radio.
And these were previous owners then, before you had purchased, or these were people that you came to work for when you first got here?
I came to work for Gordon, actually Gordon Capps. And he and Lee Jacobs were the ones that actually hired me. And then I worked for them for a number of years before I became manager. And then after a period of years, then I bought the radio station. And then I sold to Brian and Bill Crystal in 1985.
Okay. And just as a side note here, you had mentioned earlier that Gordon Capp was a great guy, and you wanted just to mention he still is.
Yeah, he still lives in Ontario, and don't hear from him often, but occasionally.
Okay. And I wanted to mention you had such a large part of your life dedicated to radio and to your business, but that certainly wasn't all that you did. You were very, very busy. Can you tell me about some of the things that you were involved in?
Well, I received a few awards and was involved with a variety of clubs and organizations. Received the Man of the Year Award from the Grand Union County Chamber of Commerce in 1971, the Distinguished Citizens Award from the Le Grand JCs, that was in 1957. I served on the board of directors of the Salvation Army, the Red Cross, and I chaired the blood program for the Red Cross for a number of years. I was a member of the Elks Lodge and the Le Grand Lions Club, member of the First Christian Church, and held numerous offices there, sang in the choir for over 50 years. I recorded two religious albums. I did a number of concerts, sermons and song and solos, and sang for hundreds of funerals and a number of weddings. And
do you still sing today?
No, unfortunately, I had a neurological problem crop up about 6 years ago, and that took my singing voice.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that about wraps that up.
Okay. Well, let me just ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
About these. What was the motivation for your leadership in all of these organizations, such as the Blood Program and Salvation Army? It seems that you weren't just a volunteer, but you really had prestigious positions with them.
Gee, I don't know. You know, you get involved with community things, organizations and all, and there was a need, and you filled it, and to be elected or appointed chairman of something or president, why, you said sure you'd do it, and I guess they thought I could handle the job.
Do you think that you are more aware of all of these things going on because of your role in radio?
Oh, definitely.
So yes. That definitely impacted your
role?
Oh, yes.
You bet.
Okay. And then I wanted to ask a few more questions about your involvement in the church. 50 years on the choir, that's quite an achievement, as well as all of the other things. But tell me about some of the changes that occurred within the church. I understand that maybe you were in a couple of different buildings over
yes.
that time.
When my wife and I first started going to the Christian church, it was still on Penn Avenue, but about, I don't know, 4 or 5 blocks east of there. And then we built the building that we are currently in. It's the First Christian Church, and we were involved in the building of the church, or the building itself. My wife, I know, did some painting and sanding and this sort of thing, and I took a number of movies of the progress on the building. And yeah, there's been a lot of changes made. I don't know that I could really enumerate all of them, mm-hmm. but it's been a big part of my wife and my lives.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's also a big part of, I guess, others in Union County? Is it what makes La Grande a special place, or is it really not related, in your opinion?
You mean the churches?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure that they have their place in the community, and probably makes La Grande a nice place to live.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for that. As you kind of reflect on your life in Union County, is there anything else that's sort of on the top of your head that you would like to discuss?
Nothing really comes to mind particularly.
Do you suppose you would ever want to redo any of it or live anywhere else, or have you been very pleased with your time in Union County?
No, I think that La Grande has been very good to me, and I don't think I would change my life, my life's work at all, because I enjoyed radio and I enjoyed serving in the community. Singing has been a big part of my life, and something that might be of interest, I don't know. I went to a radio broadcast school in Beverly Hills, California. One of the instructors moved to Portland to run a broadcast school there, and she said, when I get things going the way I want them to, I want you to come to Portland and we'll get you a job in radio. So I had all set up to leave on the bus that afternoon about 5 o'clock. The first thing I did that morning, probably around 8 or 9, was to mail some letters in the post office, and I was hurrying down the steps, and I turned my ankle, pulled 2 ligaments, and fell, of course. Well, that delayed my going to Portland for a month. But you know, if that hadn't have happened, I probably would never have come to La Grande, because I'd been in Portland about a month, which was about a week or so before Thanksgiving. I did get a job at KVAN in Vancouver, Washington, But that lasted just a week because a staff announcer was ill. And then I got the opportunity to come to Le Grand. But you see, if I'd been in Portland a month early, that would not have happened. Mm-hmm. So, sort of a coincidence, I guess.
Well, I think it sounds to me like it wasn't really an accident. You were supposed to be here.
I believe you're right. Yeah.